Accession number 3790, Reel 1.
Mr. Johnson, Reel 1.
Okay.
Now, I believe you said that you came to England as early as 1933.
Yes, I arrived on the 31st of July, 1933. And I went to school here first.
Why did you come to school here?
Well, I was 17. I'd broken my education in Germany. My father wanted to send me originally to France, which I refused to do because in German schools you had a... There was a certain antagonism after the First World War against the French and not so much against the English. And so I refused to go to France, which was my luck. And when my father heard some of his friends were sending boys to England to the school, I was asked, would you go there as well? So I said, yes. So I went to England.
Did this have anything to do with the rise of Hitler? Or was
yes, of course. Of course. I mean, I was not yet forced to leave the school, but it was going that direction.
Did you know English before you came here?
Well, I had English at school from the fourth year of my secondary school. English was limited. I had to do the Merchant of Venice for my O-levels. And I had a tutoress. And I quite enjoyed it. I went to see the play in English. And it was one of the two plays I saw in English when I was a boy.
Did your parents know English?
My mother knew some English. She'd been in England in 1929 for the first time. My father had a little bit of English. They both had French. My father learned Latin at school. But I learned French from the 10th year, and in my 14th year I started with English.
What did you intend to do or hope to do?
Well, I came here to go to school first, and I went in for my matric at Regent Poly in 1934, and I pipped all subjects but German because I was just fed up with school by that time. And I had difficulties to decide on what to learn. The refugee committee suggested I should take up either hairdressing or tailoring or plumbing or become an electrician, but as I had two left hands, I didn't fancy to going into any artisan thing. And so it was a bit complicated. And my father had very few connections. He could have put me in the textile trade, which he was in, but I wasn't interested. And eventually I was placed with somebody in the fur trade as a trainee. That was in November 34. And I stayed with that firm until 1940, until I was interned. And in 1939, in July, I got my permanent labor permit, which meant that I could change the firm and I did not have to reapply for labor permit. And theoretically, I could then have applied for naturalization, but I wanted to wait a few months, and then the war started. And it wasn't possible.
Was it difficult coming here as a young boy, being completely transplanted to a different culture?
Well, I went to a school where there were 17 boys altogether who came from Germany, under similar circumstances. We had a boy who came from, who was here from Egypt, whose mother tongue was French and Italian, and he went to school here. And we had a student in our school from Iraq. And we tried to speak as much English as possible. And at night, I talked in my dreams in German, then I talked a mixture of English and German, and then I turned into bad English. And we started a little group, four of us, paying a farthing for every German word. And when we had reached the stage that we only spoke English, we blew it and went to the pictures and had some bought some fruit. And that was, I suppose, in the autumn of 39. And the bus conductor told me once, I was running out with a dictionary, he said, throw that damn thing away, speak with mistakes. It's much better to pick up the language that way.
Did you pick it up fairly quickly then?
Well, my pronunciation was lousy anyway, it's still lousy now, but it wasn't so difficult because English grammar is negligible, and the grammar which there is, you don't neglect anyway, as long as you know the main idioms, and as long as you know a few swear words.
Now, were you trying to speak English just so that you could fit in better here, or did you definitely refuse to speak German because it was the language of Hitler?
That's right. Well, I refused to speak English, and in 1937, my father came here, and he complained that I was speaking no German. And he said, you mustn't forget your mother tongue because it's very important. Firstly, as a cultural tie. Secondly, as a tie to your family. And thirdly, it will come in handy at one time when you may need a second language. He was perfectly right. In 1937, I joined two clubs. One was a refugee club, and which was run by West London Synagogue, called the 33 Club. And I joined the International Friendship League. And I joined both of them, actually, because they had rambling clubs. And that's where how I made my first friends in this country, really. And I went to the theaters from the second week I was in England. And I learned a lot from the theater. I went to Hyde Park to listen to the speakers. I learned a lot of bad language, but I also learned some English.
I assume your parents were supporting you at this time.
My father was supporting me, was able to support me until he left the country end of 1937. Then he emigrated to Holland, where he had had a sister and relations. My mother stayed in Germany until June 39 as a beauty culturist, and in 39 she came to England and took a job as a housekeeper companion cum cook at Camp Lodge near Stroud in Gloucestershire. And she came to London 6 months later because she couldn't stand the climate.
That was about the only way that women could get into England at
exactly.
that time.
Exactly. You could take a job in a hospital or in domestic. That was the only way, really, at the time. And there, unfortunately, were too many, too proud to take a job like that. And so they were left behind. And the person to whom that happened was the sister of Vicky the cartoonist, Vicky Weiss. And they were born Hungarians. And Vicky came to England. And after a while, he joined the News Chronicle. And his brother was a farrier. He was a cutter. And his mother came with him. But the sister stayed behind. She was sent to Hungary. From there, she was sent to a concentration camp. She only came out of the country after the war.
How did your mother get on with the domestic job?
Well, she was very tidy. She had imagination, but she didn't like cooking, but she had imagination. As she was a beauty culturist, she was able to humor people, and that was the most important thing because this old lady was very helpful, and she was a very educated person, and they got on like a house on fire, and they were friendly all through the war, and they kept in contact till after the war. I mean, the thing is, that's the unfortunate thing, that the majority of people who came out of Germany and Austria were middle class, were educated people, and they either had the imagination to make contacts abroad or had a job where they could find a job abroad, whilst the so-called working class amongst the Jews found it less easy, unless they went on Hasharah and went to Israel eventually, into kibbutzims.
Why didn't your father stay in Britain while he had the opportunity?
My father wasn't in Britain. My father went to Holland. My father emigrated to Holland in 1937. My mother came to England in 1939. My parents were divorced in 1934.
So did he have felt uncomfortable then coming here because she was...
No, he had... No, no. He left the country in 1937. And he went to Holland, where he had relations. My mother came in 39, 2 years later, to England.
Had your father any plans to come to England?
No. No, he was staying with... I went to see him a week before war broke out, and he said, Holland will never be invaded. The Germans didn't invade in the First War. Why should they invade now? So that we have got different ideas about that. You will be invaded. And when the war started, of course, I tried to get him out, but he thought nothing would happen. I mean, he was offered to be taken underground, but he didn't want to chance it. So he was deported in 42, Auschwitz. My father was in the Pioneer Corps during the First World War. He was stationed in Poland. And he didn't have an Iron Cross. There were plenty of Jews who had an Iron Cross. And they thought there were more Germans than Jews. And it just wouldn't happen, being such a cultured nation, so-called. It didn't work out that way.
Had you been brought up in a fairly religious Jewish
background? No, I was... My father was very, very irreligious. I dropped a klanger. When I was 10 years old, I went to secondary school. I didn't know about the Jewish high holidays. And the first day of the new year, of Rosh Hashanah, I went to school. And some of the non-Jewish boys told me, for heaven's sake, go home in the interval. Otherwise, the school teachers think that it's a minor holiday. So, and don't come in 10 days' time. So I had to tell my father, and he said, yes, they're quite right, I should really close my business, which he did after that. This is how religious we were. I mean, I became more of a conscious Jew in England, and I'm very pleased I became more of a conscious Jew. And one can have dual loyalty. I'm quite sure one can.
Tell me about your tribunal. That would have been in the...
I better start. When the war started, we had to give up any maps, bicycles, radios, compasses, anything which had slight connection with security, either give it to the police or deposit cameras, of course, binoculars. Or to English friends, and I gave it to my former headmaster.
This must have been a bit of a blow to you as a keen rambler.
Yes, exactly. It was a nuisance. But anyway, on the 12th of December, I was called for tribunal, and I was given C grade. There was A grade, B grade, C grade, and A grade were locked up straight away. The B grade were mainly people who were living at the coast, over there where the police had certain doubts at the Home Office, and C where we called ourselves the friendly enemy aliens. And then I could collect my maps and everything back, and so I spent Christmas 1939 youth hosteling at the youth hostel home in St. Mary. And I had a lovely weekend, and I started walking as soon as I could again. And then after Dunkirk, of course, the internment started, and alternatively, people were fetched to Lingfield at Kempen Park. There was a curfew on, and to avoid the curfew, quite a number of the elderly gentlemen sat in the Lion's Corner House at Marble Arch all night playing cards so that they couldn't be picked up by the police. Well, I wasn't that clever. Anyway, a friend of mine was picked up on the 26th of June, was taken to Lingfield, but I was already on the way to work. So I packed my case that evening, and I was collected on the 28th of June and taken first to Albany Street barracks, and from there I was taken with other people by lorry to Kempen Park.
Before we get to the internment, could you tell me about your tribunal?
Well, the tribunal, they asked the basic questions, why I came to England and what I was doing here, and if I... would want to stay in this country, because there was quite a number of people who came to this country in transit. They were mainly in Kitchener Camp, and they were in transit here before going on to another country, whilst I came here to stay in England.
Who were the people who made up the tribunal? I don't mean what were their names, what sort of people?
Well, I should think that the tribunal was comprised partly of coroners or any trained judges, but lay judges, people with common sense. And actually a funny thing happened the year after the Dunkirk business. Shall I put this in? Well, a friend of mine was in 93 company, I believe, with his father. He and his father originated from Bremen. And they had been with France with the three alien companies during the lull before the withdrawal from Dunkirk. And they were the companies 87, 188, and 93. Well, they were retrieved from St. Malo. While the British soldiers threw their rifles away, our friends, our refugees, picked up the rifles and said, "We are not going to let the Germans have them. We are taking those back to England, whatever it costs." So they came from St. Malo to England, and they were sent on to Biddeford, North Devon, in a survival camp, and were given a week or fortnight survivor's leave and came back to their wives. A couple of this period fell out in the internment period, after Dunkirk, of course. And one morning, my friend is called to the door, policeman outside. "We have come, we want to see Mr. Van Dyck Sr." So he said, "Well, come in." And my friend was wearing his uniform, his Pioneer Corps uniform, and he looked at him. "You in the army?" He said, "Yes, I'm on survivor's leave." So he called up to his dad, who was shaving, get dressed quickly, there's a copper down here." So he came down in his uniform. So he said, "Germans in uniform, in British uniform?" Police didn't know. The judges didn't know. Anyway, so they both went to the tribunal. And of course, they showed their army papers. They showed their army pass, their AV-64. And they showed their army pass, that they had leave from the army. And the judge shook his head and said, "The Home Office should have told us that." Well, the police didn't know, and the judges didn't know. Now, so it was a very amusing episode. Just the usual blunders. I mean, they got to know these blunders of the Home Office afterwards when they were interned.
You said you kept on with your job right until the time of internment.
Yes.
Were people disappearing around you at work?
Well, at work, not so many. A few, yes. A few.
Or were the people who were working there people who had been resident in Britain long enough so they might have taken out naturalization?
Well, you see, some had naturalization. They were not interned, of course. Some had been naturalized and so were not interned. I mean, there were in our trade quite a number of linguists. One was born of Russian parents. He was born in Germany, I think. He may have just been born in Russia, I think, just before the revolution, before the 17th revolution. He came to Leipzig, became naturalized there. Then they came to England. They were naturalized here. They were employers. One of them was a lieutenant colonel in intelligence. I'm very friendly with him. I'm doing business with him. But he had about five or six languages. He was very useful to the war effort. So were some others of our lot.
And most of your friends and associates at this time, I gather, were other refugees, Germany,
yes.
Austria.
Well, in the fur trade, partly, in my refugee club, yes, but not in the International Friendship League, because the International Friendship League was started in 1932 by the retired Indian civil servant, brother of Shuta Eid, who was Home Secretary during the war, in the national government. And Shuta Eid's brother, Noel Eid, started International Friendship League, and one of his friends, who led me on a ramble in the Lake District in 1942, is Lord Ted Short, I knew him as Ted Short, and he is now a senior minister in the government. And he was a very active member in Newcastle as a young schoolmaster with his wife when I knew him during the war.
What sort of reaction, emotions, did you get from ordinary British people with whom you came in contact who were not in the International Friendship League?
Well, the people I knew were abhorred by the idea of the Home Office to intern people, because they were under the impression that Scotland Yard and the Home Office was well aware whom they had in the country, and they should have known from their records who was who. But after Dunkirk, of course, people got rattled, and the Germans being dropped behind the lines in Holland and in Belgium, I mean, I could understand that some people were rattled. Some of my friends never got over the internment, and they don't like living in this country for this reason, although they may be British.
Why do you think the government went ahead with the internment?
Well, there was a very strong pressure group that, as one didn't know for quite sure who was safe and who was not safe, rather to intern people, to intern some of the safe ones, and to make sure that nobody escaped the net. But, I mean, I met before the war in this country, in a restaurant on the West End, a man who was Jewish, who had been in the Black Reichswehr, who had been in the German army, which was trained in Russia. There was an arrangement between the Reichswehr and the Russian army whereby the Germans supplied technical information to the Russians, and the Russians trained several thousand of Germans from the army for a year in modern warfare, including tank warfare, which was not permitted under the Versailles Treaty to the Germans. And, I mean, this man was interned like everybody else. But then there were also Nazis here who were preparing to take over when the Germans invaded. And I met one of these gentlemen in the internment camp in Huyton, outside Liverpool, and Mr. Wilson's constituency to be. And he tried to swap with somebody who was scheduled to be sent to Australia. He wanted to stay behind because he wanted to become a Gaolite in England. And he stayed behind. And he became a naturalized British subject earlier than some Jews, because he went into the export business at the end of the war. This is one of these stupid anomalies which were never checked by the Home Office.
Do you think that because of people like him, the government were justified in their internment?
Well, it's a moot point. It's a moot point. I mean, under duress, you do all sorts of things, and it was probably a safeguard. I mean, I don't blame the British. It was annoying, but it was better to be interned here than to be interned in Germany.
Obviously. It always seemed to me that it wasn't so much that there was a dreadful threat of German spies and infiltrators, but that the government were desperate at the time of Dunkirk and felt they had to be seen to be doing something.
Exactly, quite. Exactly. Especially after what happened in Holland and Belgium.
Yes. I think you said you tried to join St. John's Ambulance.
Yes, well, I went on St. John's Ambulance course. I tried to join the Red Cross first, but of course the British Red Cross takes only British subjects. So I joined the St. John's Ambulance, and I went on a course, having done first aid and the Boy Scouts, as long as I can remember. And I don't think I passed, because I couldn't distinguish some of the bones they showed me. But I did first aid in the army. In internment first, I was orderly, and I did first aid work in the army, actually tried to get in the medical corps that I pipped, but it was just as well. I did a bit of work in that respect. I learned quite a lot.
Had you given any thought to the Pioneer Corps before the time of independence?
No, I didn't. Well, I didn't. You see, this is the point. I wanted to stay in emergency services, auxiliary services, and as long as my father was in occupied territory, at that time, I did not want to join the army. And as I said before, there were three companies who were serving in France, alien Pioneer Corps companies, 280 men each, and there were some other companies being raised. But when I was interned, I changed my mind. I saw that as the only alternative for me to help the war effort, because I was not in a profession or in a trade where I could help the war effort to defeat the Germans. And that's why I volunteered when Major Layton came out to Australia to join the army, to come back.
What happened to the fur trade during the war?
Well, the fur trade became stagnant, of course. I don't think they could import anything. There were still supplies here. If they could get something in, it would have been from soft currency countries, from British possessions. And it stagnated. It carried on, of course. But the people who were linguists and were young enough, of course, joined the army or the air force or the navy or whatever have you.
Could you tell me about your first few days in internment when you were in the transit camp?
Well, in Kempton Park, we were on palliasis, I should think, the usual way. And I don't think we stayed there more than a night or two. And I can't remember if we went by lorry, but I should think we went by train to Liverpool, because it would have been crazy to send so many people by lorry, and the lorries were wanted by the army. And we had so little transport here. I should think we went by train. Well, in Huyton, outside Liverpool, Huyton was being constructed as a suburb of Liverpool, and the houses were not completed, and they usually put the elderly people into the houses and the younger ones in the bell tents on palliasis.